And good morning, good morning. It is 5 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to Positively Revolting on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And, you know, we host the show every Friday morning. It looks at a number of issues from issues of sustainability, the environment, human rights, civil rights, how we all, you know, try to make the world a better place.
Everything from soup to nuts.
Things we are for, things we are again. All of it coming to you Friday mornings, 8 to 9 o'clock on, you know, your local talk radio of the progressive nature. Progressive, fair enough to say.
Oh, yeah. Right here at KBOO.
Right. So,
in Portland.
This morning, we are talking about the People's Water Trust. And to do just that, to talk about it with us, joining us here in the studio are Nick Caleb, an attorney and professor at Concordia University, who's also one of the authors of the People's Water Trust, as well as Jonah Major, who is the chief petitioner. Good morning, y'all.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. Let's jump right into things. There's a lot to discuss in the next, say, 50 minutes or so. Nick, let's start with you. As the author of the measure, how did this initiative come into being? What was the inspiration for it?
So it's inspired by a kind of ancient legal doctrine called the public trust doctrine. And basically the public trust doctrine is this piece of law that's kind of hung around for almost two millennia. And it pops up at different times during history, but it's very democratic in what it says. Basically it says that some things are so vital to the public interest that they can't be dedicated to solely to private control or to be used solely for exploitation, because societies that do that to themselves don't live very long and hang around. So this sort of law is something I studied when I was in law school. One of my mentors, Mary Wood, is a very famous law professor who just published a book on it as well. And this idea has always stuck with me. I really like the idea of having sort of levers to make your government act in the public interest. So I've been thinking about how to apply trust law to a city for a while. Specifically what happened, there's more sort of like a human story for how it happened. But basically last summer, there was an occupation of the reservoirs, mm-hmm. Because people were trying to draw attention to the politics of the reservoir and how it's been going for the last 10 years or so, putting in new reservoirs and shutting down the old. And Portlanders, for good reason, really love their gravity-fed, Bull Run-fed reservoir system.
It's the best.
It is. It's great. And it works really well, amazingly well. Super elegant design. And so out of that, people just started talking more about what if we could organize around water issues, if we could do something that was really forward thinking, and if we could run a campaign on it. And basically 10 or 12 people committed to doing it. So over the course of the next 3 months or so, almost informally but sort of coordinated, we ended up writing a law called the People's Water Trust. We took all sorts of input from trust attorneys, from legal experts at Lewis and Clark, from generally public interested people. We asked members of the community, like, what are the sorts of things that you would want to see in a law? Like, what would be worth getting behind? And the end product of that became the People's Water Trust.
Excellent. And so this all sort of came about last fallish. Let's talk about what you hope to do with it. So I have to agree, water is, well, a very precious resource, right? Without water, life itself is not sustainable. And we've seen some interesting things over the last year. The most notable to me was the CEO of Nestle, you know, declaring that water is not a human right. It's a commodity, like any other foodstuff. I mean, that's just anathema to me. That's just unthinkable, right? And Nicholas, I think you've really hit it on the head when you say that there are some things that are just too precious, right? Water certainly is a good example of that. So what does this do? What does the trust law, how would it come into play? What would the People's Water Trust do with our water system?
Well, that was a really good lead-in. The first thing that it does is that it establishes water rights for all Portlanders. So Specifically, all residents, not just citizens, residents, anybody who lives in this area would have access and use to the right to access and use clean, affordable water at all times. And another right that would be granted would be rights for local ecology, so nature's rights. Nature would have, within the city limits of Portland and then hopefully later beyond, would have the right to exist and flourish. So this is all really, really forward-thinking stuff. Basically, you know, what you said about Nestle, this is a direct repudiation of that and saying, actually, no, we do have rights and we can assert them on a local level. And there are good reasons for asserting those rights, too. I mean, with Nestle, they've moved into the gorge, are privatizing water not too far from here. In California, you see massive droughts, record-breaking droughts all the time. Water is becoming a very scarce resource, just like it was people have been predicting for many years that it would be.
Mm-hmm. The oil of the 21st century. I remember folks back in the 80s saying, water will be the oil of the 21st century, and that has certainly come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so we have to take steps. We can't just sort of be reactionary in our politics and wait for threats until we start to take this seriously. We need to be very forward-thinking and start to develop sustainable and democratic means to manage our water before we actually have a threat. So this gives rights, and then in order to secure those rights, we've established what's called a trust, the People's Water Trust. And the People's Water Trust, more or less, and we'll, I'm sure we'll end up talking specifically about a lot of these throughout the day, puts a series of strict duties of transparency, accountability on city officials so that they have to manage the water in the public interest. And they owe loyalty, first and foremost, to all residents, as opposed to like their campaign donors or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be allowed to privatize water under any circumstances at all. They'd have to have competitive bidding for city contracts. They'd have to protect the Bull Run watershed, pretty much any water within the city's jurisdiction or control. And it gets complicated because there's always mixed jurisdictions and legalities or whatever. But whatever the city has a say in that affects water, which is a whole bunch of stuff, they would be forced to act in the public's interest. And if they didn't do that, if through independent monitoring by residents and people just sort of paying attention, the city was not following its new duties, what really makes this a progressive measure and what really gives it teeth is that we grant the right for all residents to enforce this through a public interest action if these rights are infringed
upon. What does that look like? What's public interest action?
That means that these rights that we're granting are public rights. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as like you have a piece of property and, you know, if somebody steps on it, you get to kick them off for trespassing or something like that. Water is a public right. We all have equal access
to
it.
So something we share in.
You're talking about the commons.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's a great way of putting it. And so if our commons are infringed upon, I mean, for example, if you have a watershed or Johnson Creek, for example, Johnson Creek, if it gets polluted, mm-hmm. cannot defend itself.
Sure.
Right? It doesn't have a lawyer that can like step into court. So we have to do that for it. And so we would be able to sue whoever's infringing on the rights of Johnson Creek in the name of Johnson Creek and make sure that its rights to exist and flourish are not infringed upon by the city. And it could be, you know, generally speaking, these are larger issues of infringement that would the city's, excuse me, residents would have the ability to redress in court if they needed to. But my thinking is that, you know, some people said, well, okay, this is going to open the door to frivolous lawsuits. First of all, that's not true just because you can't file a frivolous lawsuit anytime. There are rules against that in the judicial system. So this doesn't grant any other opportunity for people to sort of like do crazy stuff.
Right.
But when you have citizen law pursuit provisions, what happens is you end up evening the playing field between the residents and the government entities right away. And if the government knows that you have the ability to enforce the trust and they don't want to get sued, then they will negotiate in good faith. So we think that this will immediately have an effect on the dynamics of water policy, just in terms of like whose say matters. And we think that for a variety of reasons that we'll probably get into over the course of the day, that we would rather have the watchdogs outside of City Hall having a little bit more say in how water policy is done.
A little more watching.
A little more watching.
Okay.
Well, I want to, excuse me, remind folks that this is a call-in program. You can call in with your questions or comments at 503-231-8187. You can also follow along on Facebook, where we post links and articles and, well, sometimes have conversation with each other throughout the week. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us as Positively Revolting, of course. You can also email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Also, wanted to make a little announcement. Miriam, who has been a guest in the past a few times and who works with No Nukes Northwest, has let us know that No Nukes Northwest is holding a gathering on Tuesday 3/11, that's next Tuesday, at noon at the Japanese Consulate in Portland. It's marking the third anniversary of Fukushima and the ongoing catastrophe there. She asks that people join them to ask the Japanese Prime Minister to keep all nukes shut down and to stand with Japan. So that is next Tuesday at noon at the Japanese Consulate in Portland, remembering the beginning of the Fukushima tragedy and catastrophe ongoing in its nature. So wanted to get that out there, let listeners know there's a lot of stuff happening all the time, and we try to keep people connected here at Positively Revolting. Jonah, we haven't heard so much from you yet this morning.
Hi.
So you are the chief petitioner for the campaign. Let us know how the campaign is going. Can you tell us a little bit about where things are at right now with the People's Water Trust?
It's going splendidly. I'm just floored every time I meet with people about the Water Trust with, you know, the positive response we get. I've never seen anyone excited about any sort of political campaign like I've seen people excited about this. So, and you know, I think it's because this is something that actually does something to fundamentally change, you know, the system that we have in place that is kind of providing all these incentives for a lot of the, you know, injustices we see in our society. So I think it's really helpful. And yeah, basically what we're trying to do right now is we're trying to educate people as much as possible so they can go out into their community and they can kind of spread the good word of the People's Water Trust and, you know, educate other people and get them involved. So a lot of that looks like right now signature gathering, but because we're an all-volunteer staff, we don't have any paid signature gatherers at this point, and basically we're kind of crowdfunding our campaign. And I think what will be most effective in this campaign will be kind of empowering everyone to take ownership of it. We're not some political action committee that is organizing everything from the top and saying like this is how it's going to be and you're going to fall in line or whatever, like most political campaigns are, unfortunately. We're actually, you know, trying to get folks to take ownership of it and, you know, run this campaign in their own way with their own interests, and
with the roots in the grass.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, we're running usually one or two orientations a week, getting a good turnout at orientations. And the idea is, you know, when folks show up to those orientations and learn kind of all the ins and outs of the People's Water Trust, as well as, you know, the legalities of signature gathering, because, you know, we have a lot of new laws that we have to follow that, you know, are different from what we're used to with just being activists. So kind of training people on that, and then they can go out and they can hold their own orientation, or, you know, talk to community organizations that they're a part of, talk to their neighborhood association, talk to, you know, their neighbors, and really get folks excited about it. And hopefully we just build this massive grassroots network throughout the city that will, you know, propel this into one of the most fun and exciting campaigns that has ever been taking place in the city.
And grassroots really seems like the right phrase for this. I mean, we often see, AstroTurf roots.
Yes, that is how we say that.
You know, and you know, all of these other, yeah, for a lot of people who are pretty turned off to electoral politics, including ballot initiatives, you know, I think that's oftentimes the reason is people have been lied to so often about who's backing what. But again, just to be clear, what is your campaign doing around, you know, finances and making sure that you're staying grassroots oriented instead of drifting?
So right now we have a Act Blue crowdfunding campaign. So just plain old folks can donate online very easily.
And that's to the Cascadian Public Water Trust Initiative. That's the name of the website.
So the website, kind of easier, is just peopleswatertrust.org. So folks can go to peopleswatertrust.org, and there's a little button on there that says, like, donate now. And right now, basically all that money is going towards, you know, clipboards, printing. We're looking at starting to get some swag, some like t-shirts, stickers, lawn signs, all that kind of stuff. So
paper clips,
banners. Yeah. So right now it's mostly going towards office supplies and, you know, stuff with a logo on it. And, you know, we think having a strong visual presence will be very important with this campaign. You know, when you see Charlie Hales's pack, the Stop the Bull Run Takeover, and the Public Water District pack, you know, they're not really a visceral kind of group of folks. They're not, they don't have the same creativity as, you know, a grassroots Portland-based campaign is going to have. You know, we have lots of artists and musicians and all sorts of people involved with Water Trust that are, you know, able to create things of beauty that express their relationship to water, their relationship to the city, their relationship to the bioregion. And I think it's really important that, you know, we're showing that, like, our humanity through that. So I guess a lot of our costs are going towards, you know, having a presence right now.
I, that makes sense for a campaign. You want to have a presence.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be too stealthy.
Should we take a caller?
In fact,
Steve is on the line.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Your guest just spoke to this a little bit. The issue at hand is the initiative we're going to vote on in May, which, in my opinion, I actually agree with Mayor Hales on this. It is an attempt to take over Bull Run by an AstroTurf campaign. And whatever good the city is doing as regards the concerns your guest has expressed, they're doing a lot of restoration around Johnson Creek and also the Clean Streets Initiative. And the initiative that we're going to vote on in May, the big money behind that would actually question those functions that the city's worked upon.
So let's be clear about what's happening in May and what's happening in November, first of all, because I think there's some confusion about that.
Yeah, huge piece of confusion.
So the People's Water Trust would be on the ballot in November. We're collecting signatures right now. So the water district is in the May primary coming up here right now. So the gentleman caller is absolutely correct that that's like the campaign that's definitely in the public's eye right now. Well, we can tell you that, say that both were to pass, the duties that are in the People's Water Trust would apply equally to a citizen water board than it as it would to a city, all of these really strict duties of management. We also differ in that we don't seek to create a different structure. Like, we do appreciate that there are really good programs within the city, especially within the Bureau of Environmental Services. And so we actually have language within the People's Water Trust that would mandate that those types of programs be kept running. And I know a lot of people fear that with a takeover of the water system and moving it to a public water district, that the first thing to go would be sort of like these Bureau of Environmental Services type programs, because they're, you know, some people like Siltronics think that they're not essential to water management. And we totally disagree with that.
Well, not their style of water management.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. Right. We think environmental management is the core of water management, that if you really want to do watershed management, you can't just sort of like protect the source and a bunch of pipes on the way to people's homes. Like, you have to protect an entire ecosystem. So we want to push it forward. We think, instead, rather than sort of like putting any of these great programs in question, that the People's Water Trust would be a huge shot in the arm to the environmental movement within the city of Portland.
So you're taking a position against the initiative in May then?
So we don't have the resources to be like campaigning for or against anything that's going on right now. We're very, very focused on just signature gathering in general. If you would ask any individual that's affiliated with the campaign, they'll have their own opinions, of course. But basically the goal of and one of the reasons why I'm happy to be on KBOO right now, because I'm usually on talking about why something crappy is happening, that this is the first time I've ever been on KBOO when we're like, hey, we have this like attempt to be a national model moving forward with all these great duties and stuff like that. So if you were to ask me on the street what my opinion is, I'd have no trouble telling you what that is. As far as the campaign goes, we're just sort of focused on our campaign.
Okay. Well, I'll just give my opinion. Vote no in May.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks very much. And I think that it's important to, I thank Steve for calling in with that comment this morning, because I think it is important to realize that there are two different things happening. When I talked to a few different folks yesterday about talking with you in the People's Water Trust, immediately I started getting questions from them about the public utilities. And I was saying, these things are different. These things are not the same. And I think that that is right now. Just with my very little foot on the ground talking to some folks, that seems to be an issue that'll, let's just say, leaves you a lot of room to clarify.
Right. But it's also a really good opportunity, because people are investing themselves in the issue of water again. And, of course, yeah. Water politics are always going in Portland and are always a subject of scrutiny. But we have, when we started running this, people said, okay, well, this is going to be so confusing for citizens and that are going to vote on this. Nobody's going to have any idea what's going on. And there may be confusion about it. But the great thing about Portland is that people actually want to learn this stuff. And so you may be confused on one day, but, you know, instead of sort of just falling away from the political debate, a lot of times people will investigate. And as people devote energy to it, and as these things become more clear closer to the May election, it's going to be really obvious what the distinctions are between our type of water management and the Portland Water District's management styles are?
Well, say I'm just a person that's, like myself, not very well versed in a lot of water policy. I mean, I hear, like, I'm upset that the reservoirs are going to be covered. Why is water so expensive? How would the Public Water Trust deal with those sort of bread and butter, as they say, issues?
Right. So in general, you know, we faced a few questions of, like, is this going to increase costs? Or was this going to affect my water bill? So we don't have, there's nothing in the People's Water Trust that says that we have to create new institutions, or that we have to add a new bureau, or that we have to make huge expenditures. Pretty much everything that is in the People's Water Trust is just adjustment of city policy. Like, the individual bureaus will have to take the water trust into account when they make policy, and they'll have to justify their policies in written statements to the public. But none of that should cost any more than regular administrative time. So we don't foresee there being massive costs at all associated with the People's Water Trust. Quite to the contrary, it should streamline a lot of operations within the city. So, for example, one of the duties is for transparency in process at all times. And probably a lot of the listeners have dealt with the city in some way, trying to request documents of some kind. Very difficult to get documents from the city. And people are always surprised when they find out that Portland, you know, has such low transparency, because we just love to, you know, put our values on
our city. We think Portland's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. So you project that onto the city apparatus, and it's not always true. So, you know, a duty to, like, give people documents without undue delay or undue cost pretty much incentivizes the city to take what's already, like, electronic information and put it in an electronic format and get rid of all these layers of bureaucracy between us and the information. So actually, something like that should save money. It should become more efficient. And so a lot of our duties are just pretty simple, actually. They cut a lot of the complexities in the jurisdiction down to just, are you acting in the people's mm-hmm. interest, right?
Who defines that? What the people's interest, are they going to be defining? It's a lot of people just seem to feel powerless about what has been happening around water. I mean, they were just barely didn't have fluoride in the water that so many people vastly didn't want. I mean, that's just my impression with that resource and with the Water Bureau in Portland, is that so how would this really make, I mean, so what? How do they define the public interest? I mean, how is the Water Trust actually going to do that?
Right. So I think right now the public interest, like you say, is just sort of a rhetorical device that people can just throw it out for whatever they want to, and there's not a lot of substance to it. I think the best way to answer that question is just to talk about the duties that would apply to the city, because I think that's the straightest way to apply our version of what the public interest is. And this will be what we'll, you know, put out into the city and see if everybody agrees with us. So far, so good. The first would be loyalty to residents over anybody else as far as water policy concerned, so standard trust duty. The second would be independent accounting of water resources. The third would be the duty to use the best available science and the precautionary principle in policymaking. If there's a new development that might harm the watershed, the city would have to undertake a scientific process to decide whether it would. And if it would, then that development would not be allowed to proceed, because water we conceive as our primary resource. You know, water, if grader is sign, economic development, more or less. Yeah. That these things need to be weighed in their proper order. We strictly regulate conflicts of interest around water making policy. So if you are a public official or an elected official or a bureau head and you have relationships with people that stand to gain from your decision making, you have existing friendships and they maybe gave you a bunch of campaign contributions, all that stuff would be regulated within the People's Water Trust. So if I take more than $50 from a special interest and then that person later on sort of expects to gain through my favor as a public official, when that conflict is discovered, whatever that decision-making process that happened is voided and we start again. So we put an ethical duty on our officials to not have any conflicts. Again, no privatization of water. We think that's directly in the public interest ever. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what you call it, regionalization, whatever it is, no, can't have it. The open and transparent process, making the city contract into its contracts with private groups that would do pseudo-public functions. They would have to give them, they would have to put in language that would allow those companies to have the same oversight basically as the city would. So even our private companies can't hide behind privatization. They'd still have to be open and transparent and subject to these duties. They'd become trustees of the water too. The duty to protect Bull Run from harmful actions is one. And then just a general duty that anybody who has harmed or would harm the water sources, resources to for the city to take whatever action it possibly could to prevent that. Sometimes within its, that could just be permitting authority, like refusing to grant permits. And sometimes that could be testifying in Salem. You know, it could be going into a hearing on a DEQ type hearing and lending the city's political weight behind opposition to a harmful project. It could mean a lot of different things in a lot of different scenarios. With the water harbor superfund negotiation that's going on,
right,
this would ensure that the city would be on our team. There would be no issues with that. So those are just a few things, and that's, you know, so that's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff,
and that's probably only about like half of the duties that
are. It's a very ambitious initiative.
Yeah.
Yeah, usually you don't get to put a bunch of stuff in an initiative like this. It's usually single subject, but the city agreed with us that a trust is a single issue, so we're able to put massive amounts of reforms in a single initiative here. That's why we're so excited.
All with that public trust in mind.
Yeah.
So 503-231-8187, the number to call to join us in this conversation. You can call in with your question or your comments to Nicholas and to Jonah this morning. We are talking about the People's Water Initiative here on Positively Revolting. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. You can also email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. And we say good morning to Miriam. Good morning, Miriam. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much. What a great show. I have so much to say, and I've narrowed it down to two questions. I'm part of No Nukes Northwest, which and Radcast, which deals specifically with radiation monitoring and citizen monitoring. And my first question is, will you, and I think this dealt with number three in your duties list that you were just reading. I can't remember offhand what it was, but I think it has to do with number three. How will the city implement, and I've spoken with city council about this before, and they brushed it off like it's nothing, and it really is something, and that something is radiation that is coming down on our area and fallout. And that goes into the water. And I want to know how. All I'm saying is that the people should be protected by knowledge, you know, not from knowledge, but by knowledge. And the only way to do that with our water source is to test it for radiation readings. And we can do that. The question is, will we do that? And this is the third year of Fukushima, you know, radiation coming down in our area, plus everything else from the jet stream from years and years ago. This is real. And I'm curious about that. So that's the first question. And the second question is, I'm really wary of people of watch groups who, you know, we don't know who they're going to be. How do you choose who's in this watch group? And how do we know that the people in the watch group are going to be, like, basically as cool as, for instance, Elizabeth Warren? She's of the people and for the people and still is as a senator. How do we make sure that the people who become members of this watch group are really for the people and don't all of a sudden take interest, however that comes, in ways that are malintent, you know, whether they get paid on the side, corrupt, whatever. What's the process there, and who would these people be?
So the second question is really easy to answer.
Okay.
The beneficiary group here, the watchdog group, is all the residents of the city of Portland. So there are existing groups that sort of deal in environmental policy or have like the ability to do testing of water and stuff like that. But instead of having like a centralized control group of like who has access to all this stuff, is everybody all the time has access to it all the time and has access to the city all the time. And they all have the ability to file a public interest action against the city at any time, which means that pretty much anybody who's interested in taking on issues of water policy would have a direct avenue to do it. So very, very much direct democracy as far as enforcement goes.
How is that different from now, from what we have in place now? Because, you know, if somebody wants to, you know, demand information or get information or create a lawsuit, as long as it's valid, can't we do that now?
You can always sue, but you don't always have good reason to expect that you could win in a lawsuit. And the way that the People's Water Trust makes this a little bit different is that you have very specific duties that are the city would have to follow in order to act within our definition of the public interest. And if any of those duties were violated in any way, even arguably violated, then you would be able to enforce those, compel the city to perform those actions. And so right now we don't have duties that make this system like that straightforward. So for example, something like right now there's a proposal to remove a bunch of trees in Mount Tabor Park and mm-hmm. take out the pipes from the reservoirs, and people are scrambling and trying to get information, and the city is pretty much not being super straightforward with about how the process is going. They're not telling anybody what kind of environmental review they're going to use, and pretty much all of the cards are in the cities, and they sort of like spring the project as they want to. And they, as far as I can tell, see the public citizen input as more of an annoyance than something that's welcome. That dynamic
Definitely.
Would be completely different under the People's Water Trust, where the city couldn't just, you know, hide information from you. If you want information, you get your information. That's like one of the chief duties, and you get it without unreasonable cost and without unreasonable delay. And our definitions make that very clear, that it's pretty much immediately at almost zero cost. And so if you don't get that, then you take them to court. And, you know, no city official, once they know that that's the way that this dynamic is going to work, is going to play that game anymore, because it would just be silly. No one would want to do that. So it reshapes that dynamic right away. It puts people on an equal playing field.
Okay, and how about the other question? Thank you for your answer.
Sure. And so the answer to the second question is very similar. If citizens, residents in the city saw that radiation in the water was an emerging risk that needed to be studied, there would be very simple mechanisms for getting the city to do that. And some of our duties ask for high-grade scientific testing of the water supply for emerging risks already. So that's one of the duties as well.
Also, one big concern with radiation in the water that a lot of folks have is the Hanford site up in Washington. And, you know, as we're seeing with leaking tanks, cracks and dams, that kind of thing, you know, that's kind of a big threat to our, you know, trust here in Portland. So one thing this People's Water Trust actually establishes is bioregional cooperation as a city policy. So, you know, if any municipality near the city or in our bioregion is, you know, if there's like a threat to our water that is involved with that municipality, the city has to use its lobbyist and, you know, its influence to try and resolve that in as many ways as possible.
And the Great. Goal is that we put together something so straightforward. And a lot of it's really interesting talking to people, because, you know, people are rightly skeptical whenever they hear about new laws coming, because usually they're not so much in the public interest, or there's a catch, or there's some kind of like hidden.
Or trust has nothing to do with trust.
Right, and so when we like detail our duties, and then they're like, what's the catch? Like, when is it going to like hit? You know, when's reality going to hit? And we're like, no, it's just how it is. Like, we're doing this because we want to actually like empower citizens. It's interesting.
It's kind of a wacky concept.
We're not used to it in this country. Like, right. We're really not used to having oversight, so we're very cynical, and that's totally expected. So, but as people sort of like level questions at us, and you know, so for example, our duty for scientific testing, it says the city has a duty to use the most scientifically accurate testing methods that are reasonably available when testing water, including but not limited to utilizing special testing methods for blah 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 blah. But basically, it says straightforward: test the stuff that the citizens want you to, and that's it.
Right.
Right. And if they don't, then
You got to admit that empowerment of the people is pretty much anathema to business as usual in politics, in electoral politics, in this country, or in most countries, really. Let's go ahead and take another call. Good morning. You're on the air. Let's talk to Harry. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. One of the chief reasons for May's ballot election is the city's mismanagement and sometimes downright corruption of the of our water system. Here we are, the Columbia River is the largest river in the West, and the Willamette is the second largest river in the West. We're right there in between the two, and our water bill is higher than Phoenix, Arizona. And so a lot of the residents are really upset, so we want to take control from the city to something better. I understand your what I hear so far about your program will probably help, but the question I have is oversight of everything. Like, example, since we get our water from Bull Run and it goes downhill by gravity, a couple of months ago they've been adding generators, turbines to the water flow, and they're actually making money. But we're not too sure if this money is being used to alleviate our water bill or not. Do you know anything about that?
I haven't heard about that specifically, but I can tell you that if the People's Water Trust were law right now, that is the sort of thing that would be accounted for and available to the public.
Okay. Oh, well, one last question is to our host is March 11th is the last day you can register to become for the election for city council in November. Have any of you two thought about running for city council?
Oh, I would rather stick a sharp stick in my eye. But thank you, Harry.
Okay.
Fabulous vote of confidence.
One thing I would like to address to the People's Water Trust, with your concerns about rising costs and everything like that, a lot of times with our city government, we see that there's a lot of emergency no-bid contracts handed out, and oftentimes those contracts are handed out
because it's an emergency.
Yes, it's an emergency. It's a crisis. Yeah. So a lot of times those contracts are handed out to the same company, usually a company that's kind of buddy-buddy with the city through campaign donations or revolving door politics. So this would really help alleviate that because, there would have to be open and competitive bidding that would, make sure that we're kind of getting the best deal, the best job done, that sort of thing. And, as we see with Palo Butte right now, the construction of that obviously is not going very well since we're leaking 280,000 gallons of water a day.
So,
and
yes,
this is our expensive new reservoir that's going to, be a huge burden on our city for, a generation.
Right. And a lot of the water bills are from the bonds that we're taking out to fund that project. So, and again, like to follow what Jonah's saying, if the People's Water Trust had been law when this would have been proposed, like the reservoir, new reservoirs, underground reservoirs, the public would have had way greater access to the process. They would have been able to get documents not only from the city, but also from these companies. If the city was trying to show the need for this, they would have to have a huge burden to prove that this is something that's not only in the interest of the watershed, but also the financial interest of the citizens as well. And so we're 10 years too late on that one, unfortunately. Like most of this project is done. We've tried to put in some language that would sort of like try to help in the last stages to keep the reservoirs open up on Tabor and around the city, because we think that's really important. Just in general, to have these amazing like cultural heritage sites in the city. I have a student in one of my classes who's from the Tabor area, my cultural geography class at Concordia, and she wrote this really great paper about like the reservoirs being like an essential component of her childhood and like totally part of her memory, and like the thought that somebody would like disconnect them or destroy them or sell them off for real estate was like so damaging to her identity. It was really moving to me as well. So like having these major projects go without oversight is a huge problem, I think.
Gigantic.
Huge. Huge. Let me say this about that. We have a few things, about 15 minutes left in the show, a little less. If you would like to join us, please do. You can get on your question or your comment by calling 503-231-8187. I want to let people know that coming right up after Positively Revolting this morning will be the APA Compass program. Ismael Bea tells his story about being a child soldier in Sierra Leone. Melinda Lowe talks about her four acclaimed young adult novels. And Portland vocalist Lindy Ma talks about her performance memoir. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary will be heard with your host, Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints. The entire show today will be devoted to a special Fukushima update. Again, we are approaching the third anniversary of the catastrophe of Fukushima, the unfolding, ever-ongoing catastrophe of Fukushima. At 11 o'clock this morning, It Takes a Village, hosted by Shahid Hamid, will be discussing films depicting the African-American slavery experience. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Sutri Irving interviews Randall Stewart and Cassie Scowgi of Saruman House about the creation of Saruman as a place for the community to gather for creativity, curiosity, and ceremony. We thank all KBOO members for your generous support. You too can become a KBOO member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the fine Donate Now icon. Lynn, you have your finger in the air.
I do indeed. You were just talking about the Powell Butte Reservoir, and our intrepid news and public affairs director, Kathleen Stevenson, gave me this little thing that she had found. It was on Coin News, and it talked about that they found that nobody, the Water Bureau did not feel they had to give people any information about that. So how much transparency is necessary? Residents were asking about it, and one resident said they might be trying to cover something up, but they felt that that the Water Bureau didn't really feel that there was anything to say about it. So this is another reason that we really could use a little transparency. We could use a lot of transparency. I don't know.
Yeah, the politics in the Portland Water Bureau are really interesting, and because, you know, we don't have much access, it's hard to say like why they act the way that they do sometimes.
Which makes them all the more interesting.
It seems to me to either be like the person who's quoted in the Coin article says, like, they're not transparent because something is up, right? And they're not wanting to give it to the public, or they're not transparent because they're just like think that people are stupid and that they don't deserve this type of information.
Or they're completely incompetent.
Right. And either way, those are not good scenarios.
No, like, no. None of those are good.
And of course, they have a lot of experts who are well-trained within the Portland Water Bureau who do good work, you know, and that the point isn't to like slander an entire bureau or something like that. But sometimes the politics are not what are expected in a free and democratic society, supposedly. And so if the Water Bureau insists upon acting in that way, then we have to take some steps to sort of like open up that transparency, and I think we have a good way of doing it.
Let's go ahead and squeeze in a couple more callers. Good morning, Bob, you're on the air. Hello, Bob?
Bob
is no longer there. Apparently, Bob has gone on in his morning.
He did want to know about sewer rates, but I don't know what the... It's not a fully formed question. It's just a little...
It was a little heads up. Anyway, we're going to move on.
That's
what we're going to do.
Garrett,
good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I do actually have a question about sewer rates as well.
We'll check you out. All right.
So some properties are being built for drainage that is just not actually happening. Like my mom's house, there is no drainage in the street in that area, but because she has a corner lot and they bill it according to the frontage of your property, she pays double, but the water flows literally down the street into her basement. So she's actually taking the drainage, but being charged for the service that she is providing the neighborhood.
Right. Got what you're saying.
How lovely of her to do that.
Oh, yes.
She was awfully generous.
It's totally consensual, too.
Yeah, right.
Do you have a question beyond that?
Yes. How would this proposal allow us to challenge these types of things and say, well, this isn't actually happening in the neighborhood, so why are we paying for it?
All right.
Would we be able to use a process brought out by this initiative to do that?
To highlight the fact that there's services that are not actually helping in a way that you believe they should?
Well, we're paying for water drainage that isn't there. So
Right. Either okay. The
city should be compelled to install the drainage ducts so that we are getting the service that we're paying for, or refund us the money for the service that we're not getting.
All right. I think we got your question. Nick, do you have anything to...
Yeah. I can say it generally without knowing a ton about the issue at hand and not having the facts in front of me. It's hard to say, like, would there be a specific redress for this? But in general, trust law, whether it's in private trust or what we're trying to do with the public trust applied to the water, means that the city has to have an accounting of its expenditures, and they've got to minimize waste. So, like, you can't have the books not working out, more or less. And if when the city gives you the books, they're not working out for you, the numbers don't match up, and they're providing services, or, you know.
Garrett, we're going to have to let you go because of background noise, but just keep listening for the rest of the answer.
Sure. So if the city has a bunch of projects that it can't account for, or that citizens and residents can prove aren't being provided, that's wasteful expenditure. Or it's also fleecing the citizens if you do that, too.
Sure.
And so those types of things would be redressable. Residents would be able to challenge that under the duties and the trust.
All right.
Excellent.
I want to ask both of you, when I first started reading about the People's Water Initiative, the first thing it reminded me of, actually, was the rights of nature that was adopted into the Ecuadorian Constitution. And I was wondering if you saw similarities or had any inspiration from that direction.
About a year ago, I was living in Ecuador.
Oh, really?
Yeah, doing some farming down
there.
That. And, I have to say that, you know, I feel like this might be a little bit more effective model, just because of the already kind of established systems we have in place. This will basically tweak those systems to shift all our policy into the public interest. In Ecuador, there's kind of like a double standard in a lot of ways. You still see massive amounts of pollution going on all over the place. You see, like, industrial, you know, factory fishing vessels. You see oil spills happening every day in the Amazon, you know, that kind of thing. So it's not like everything's all hunky-dory in Ecuador just because of the Constitution shifting to reflect the rights of nature.
Sure.
But it does reflect kind of like a collective conscious of the people. Down there, it's like everyone knows that, you know, their existence is nothing without the ecosystems that sustain them. So I do think this will kind of cause that, you know, I think that consciousness shift has already happened in a lot of circles and is continuing to happen. And I think this will kind of establish it as city policy. So.
All right.
I totally agree. And I also was in Ecuador just for a shorter period of time last year and was out in the Amazon, and we had to cross through like oil company territory that was heavily fenced and had like machine gun guards. And so even though they have rights of nature, they're selling a lot of the Amazonian property to Chinese oil companies and stuff pretty quick. And so, like Jonah said, this doesn't, and you know, Ecuadorian legal system is a little bit different too. Not to say ours is completely working, but there's
and you say that as a professor and an attorney.
Yeah.
Just gonna throw that in there.
But exactly like Jonah said, we try to find, you know, the spirit of rights of nature is exactly what we would want to see. And so we take something like giving rights to nature within the city, and then we really think hard about how can we make that have teeth? Like, what is the way that we make that more than just like an advisory principle that we can all vote for and feel really good about ourselves and then allow business as usual to take place? Like, we're really interested in reform. We want substantive reform. We don't want, I'm 30, Jonah, you're 23?
22.
Like, we don't want to live in this world where, like, this crap happens all the time. It's too angering, you know what I mean? We wake up every morning, read the news, like some other sort of scandals coming away. We don't want that to be the world that we live in. We want it to be one where we have oversight and that things are actually working how they're supposed to work, and like the stories that we're told in school as children that actually would work. So we're trying to take steps to doing that.
I think one of my favorite things that has come out of this campaign is, you know, realizing that this basically does what we thought government already did for us.
Right.
Before you woke up.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Well, you know. Let's go ahead and squeeze Alex in here. We have just a few minutes left. Good morning, Alex.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I live in the state of Washington, and when your guest was describing Ecuador and machine gun emplacement, yada, 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 sounds like the state of Washington politics. So it kind of hit me home here. The question I have is, what can you do, or what do you guys have in place to protect your watershed projects, et cetera, to keep the county and the state of Oregon from having the final decision and any kind of influence on what the city of Portland does? Because up here in the state of Washington, no matter what we as a people do up here to vote, the state and the legislature, they always turn around and do what they want to do, what they feel is in their best interest, and their neighbors who do profit off of these projects.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Alex.
So what we've designed is something that's easily transferable to different jurisdictions. And it's hard to say, you know, there's a lot unknown in the future. And if we do our job and we convince people this is a good idea and we get people to appreciate the culture and we get people to really buy into bioregionalism as an idea that can work, you can foresee a system where, you know, your county and your city are like harmonizing their water resource law. It's not easy. It's not hard to take the same thing. It's only 9 pages long. It's very straightforward, and put it into county law. It's not hard to put it into state law. I mean, besides the practicalities of lobbying and stuff like that, it's not hard to put it into federal. It's conceptually very simple, right? We complicate things, I think, on purpose to keep people from accessing government a lot of times. So, but it can't just, there's no like quick trick to winning in politics. You can't just like, aha, we discovered the secret key, and like once we put it in place, everything will be hunky-dory. Like, we have a crazy future coming ahead of us. But this is one of those types of projects that has the values that we could actually apply in a broad way and start to make this cooperation happen. There's nothing to say that the state couldn't just preempt us. They totally could. That's how the hierarchy of state government works. We don't think that they would have any cause to do it, or, you know, who knows?
Right.
But there's a political penalty be paid for that too, to overstepping, you know, just like when the Democrats pushed the anti, or the I guess pro GMO legislation and upset everybody. So like, politics is, and the law are very, very closely related, and we need to develop a culture to sort of like protect ourselves from those overreaches. Hopefully we're taking those steps.
Well, we are just about out of time. We have 1 minute left. If you could give people details of how to be in touch, if they want more information, and also any public events you have coming right up, give those details in the next, say, you know, 45 seconds.
So basically, people can contact us through peopleswatertrust.org or the People's Water Trust Facebook page. And then we are also on Twitter at PWT Campaign. Follow us on Twitter. We're trying to, you know, get out in the Twitter sphere, I guess. And, you know, I think it's really important for us to, you know, coordinate with people. And like, if you want to help us set up an orientation at your home or your community center or something like that, we would really appreciate that.
And is there a kickoff party?
There is on what, March 25th?
March 26th at the Bossa Nova Ballroom. Check our Facebook page for the exact time of when it starts, but it's in the upstairs of Bossa Nova Ballroom, and there will be...
Hey, that's across the street from KABU.
Yes, there will be beer and art and music and lots of fun.
And can we ask you guys if after the, I have my clipboard in hand and just sort of like at the end, did we convince you to sign our petition on the way out?
I'll check that out. Look, we're out of time. 13 minutes into the next hour. Yes, I'm convinced. Anyway, moving on. We will, in fact, be vacating the studio now as we are encroaching on another program. We thank you for listening. We will be back next week, positively revolting as ever. And yeah, let's go sign that thing in the hallway.
Okay. Thanks,
y'all. Cheers. Thanks, y'all. Okay.
This is KBOO Portland, coming up this morning. Next, in fact, APA Compass. We're going to hear from Ishmael Bea telling his story of being a child soldier in Sierra Leone. Melinda Lowe talks about her four acclaimed young adult novels, and Portland vocalist Lindy Ma talks about her performance memoir. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints devotes the entire show to a special Fukushima update. And at 11 on It Takes a Village, Shahid Hamid hosts a discussion of films depicting the African-American slavery experience. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Sutri Irving interviews Randall Stewart and Cassie Goji of Ceremon House about the creation of Ceremon as a place for the community to gather for creativity, curiosity, and ceremony. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. You can become a member by going to kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the 24th annual Cascade Festival of African Films. Due to cancellations of screenings due to the weather earlier this month, the festival is being extended through March 8th. Please check their website for all scheduling details. AfricanFilmFestival.org.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
Good morning. You're listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. On today's program, Portland vocalist Lindy Ma sheds light on the complexities of being Chinese Welsh American and brings this to the stage in her upcoming performance memoir, Ipan, Ipan, showing next month, April 10th through 13th. In addition, author Melinda Lowe started writing because she just wanted to be the hero of her own story. She's now the author of four acclaimed young adult novels, including the sci-fi thriller Inheritance. But first, Ishmael Bea tells us his amazing story of being a child soldier in Sierra Leone and the transition to his second life in America.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sari Gametha. Ishmael Bea is an author and humanitarian with a unique past. He spent his formative years as a child soldier in his native Sierra Leone. His memoir, A Long Way Gone, brought him prominence for this issue. He has since published a novel called The Radiance of Tomorrow, a fictional account of going back and showing the hopeful side of people who have survived the war. He stopped in Portland on his tour and met me at Powell City of Books, where we talked about his survival and hopes for the future of Sierra Leone. Well, first, thank you for chatting with me from KBOO Community Radio, especially just as you got off the airplane and you're about to have a book talk right now. So thank you very much for joining me here.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This latest book, as you mentioned, is a novel. Your first book is a memoir, and the second one is a work of fiction. So before we delve into the how and the why, what is the story for our listeners?
Well, the basic story of the novel is called Radiance of Tomorrow, and the idea of the novel is really trying to look at how people return to places that have been devastated by war. How do they learn to live together? What traditions do they repair? How do they move towards the past when the future is still pulling at them? And what do they hold on to in the most uncertain times of their life? What it is that they preserve?